I became a fantasy fan after playing Dungeons & Dragons with my best bro and his older brother. And it was all very, very metal. This was the 80s.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 27. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two new comics from January 22nd, 2014. Umbral number 3 and ElfQuest number 1. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch this week, we talk with Josh Williamson, writer of Ghosted and the upcoming Nailbiter from Image Comics. Just as a reminder, we don't do reviews, but we talk a lot, so there may be spoilers from here on out.
To Commander Jason Sachs of the SS Comics Bulletin and all the ships at sea, I'm Keith Silva. The topic at hand is fantasy, and I'm not talking about the one where Aaron Myers flies in through the window with a fistful of amyl nitrate, a bottle of Tabasco sauce, and a stack of Howard the Duck comics. We're not talking about that, right? Right, okay. If you follow these confessional threads, I'm sure you're sick of me saying I grew up in the 1980s. Well, I grew up in the 1980s, when Lisa Frank stickers were all the rage and unicorns ruled the day. There's also some polyhedral dice mixed in there and a very expensive family trip to King Richard's Fair. That's fair with an E. Of all the fantasy fair I sampled as a kid, the movie Legend will always hold a special place in my geeky heart. Legend was Ridley Scott's follow-up to Blade Runner. It stars, get this, Tom Cruise, pre-Top Gun, as Jack. That doesn't really matter, except when this goblin, I think it's a goblin, it's been years, yells, "Killer duck! Killer! Killer!" I think he's talking about killing a unicorn. Again, I could be wrong. What makes Legend so memorable is Tim Curry, Dr. Frankenfurter himself. Curry plays Darkness. No, the Darkness or Mr. Darkness. Darkness. Full stop. He's a giant devil with this huge rack of horns and a chin like Jay Leno. His plan is to kill the last surviving unicorn, thereby creating eternal night. The soundtrack is by Tangerine Dream. I fucking loved that movie. It had everything. Demons, swords, a plot point involving giant platters. I think there may have been some diaphanous number with leather accents that Darkness tricks the girl character into wearing. Also, unicorns. So that's my first sexual experience with fantasy. That's what this was, right? Sexual awakening fantasies involving Tim Curry?
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. The theme of the show this week is fantasy. Not like sex, guys. Like magic and swords and dragons and elves and all that kind of stuff. The literary genre, if you will. We're looking at two books that fit solidly in that generous world and talking about what that even means in these days of mashups and derivations. Is traditional fantasy actually a thing?
I have a very vanilla definition of fantasy.
Are we talking about comics or are we talking about sex?
G'day, it's Paul Hicks, Reading Hicks from Australia on Twitter. Just wondering if I could tell you about my fantasy encounter earliest. Anyway, I think it's the Narnia books. I grew up in a reading household, and I'm pretty sure I read Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. That was the first fantasy book I ever read. Probably a pretty common one, I'd say. But if we're talking fantasy, I think the film that most impacted on me when I was young was Time Bandits. And I think that was because it was fantasy, but it had comedy, and it just seemed to be no rules about it at all. And it made no sense, and you know, I very much enjoyed showing that to my son the other day and having him sit at me in the end and say, "That makes no sense." And go, "Yeah, isn't it awesome?" Anyway, guys, keep up the good work. Cheers.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating the geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. This week's prompt asks listeners to share their first introduction to the fantasy genre, be it a movie, book, comic, or video game. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. We're posting the weekly theme on the site, on Twitter, and on Facebook for your convenience, but the rest is up to you.
Dungeons & Dragons Basic Set, 1979, was a birthday present from my grandmother. That started a lifelong appreciation of swords, sorcery, Tolkien, etc. I read a lot of books, but lived in a small town that didn't have any comic shops until the mid-80s. So the first fantasy comic I remember reading was The Realm, 1986, Arrow Comics.
And in between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers, and of course the show account, at Comics Therapy. So Aaron, how was your week? Things finally calmed down and normalized for you? It must have been a really rough re-entry after your time in the inner circle.
Yeah, it's like coming down from, you know, the golden castle down to have to mix with the unwashed masses again, you know? It's been tough.
Unwashed masses. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Pining for their comic books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It seems like it's been a million years since San Francisco. Like,
it was 2 weeks, dude. I mean, that's a long time.
Time just goes by really quickly, and this has been a weird week. I've been high on Vicodin for most of it.
Oh, that's right. We are not going to talk about why.
Oh, you mean my vasectomy?
No, we're not. I don't actually want to talk about your balls anymore. I'm good. I've had that particular quota filled. And then some.
Man, you and every other woman I've ever known.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not in the biblical sense. Let me just make that abundantly clear.
Sure. Doesn't matter.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But you're feeling better? Because you were, I mean, legitimately under the weather and affected by that particular experience?
Yeah, it's not fun. I wouldn't have gone through it if I'd known what it would be like.
Well, I'm super glad that you're educating our entire audience on the details.
I'm trying to warn the other testicles out there to save themselves.
Uh-huh.
That let my folly be a warning and a lesson to you all.
But you are feeling better?
Yeah, it's just taking a while.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm surviving.
It's been a week, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it hasn't been that long, but that's a long time for your balls to hurt.
Wait a second. You actually had that surgery on New Comic Book Day.
Yeah.
Holy shit, dude.
Yeah, that was not great planning.
Wait, no, because then you just got to read, like, the rest of the night.
Yeah, so, yes, I got to read. That was the upside of it. I mean, the downside was everything else, but it was nice to have uninterrupted time to read all my comic books. I didn't not get anything read that I bought that day.
Wait, what? That was super Dutchy. Meaning, because all you had to do was have your vasectomy and then read comics, you got all of your reading done.
Yeah, I thought I made that very clear.
I was just trying to follow. Dude, whatever. I think that it definitely speaks to your dedication to comics everywhere that you would go to such lengths to stay on top of your pull list for the week.
Yep, fully caught up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was fun. And then I, for some reason, started sorting a bunch of comic books. So the comic book room is not a mess, but there's lots of piles on the floor.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited.
Yeah.
Comics nest.
Sure. That'll be cleaned up by the time you get here.
You have like 2 months, dude. So I think you have plenty of time.
You got a lot of sorting to do.
How many comics do you have these days?
I don't really know, but it's, you know, it's like 90-ish long boxes.
How many comics can fit in a long box?
Like 275 if they're bagged and boarded.
I'm not going to do that math. That just sounds like a lot of comics.
Yeah, it's a lot. So most of them have been alphabetized, but then there's like 20 of those boxes that have just been kind of like things I've been getting and I haven't had time to really sort them. And then it's really hard, especially when you're trying to like plan for a convention or something like that, finding books to get signed, you know, like I have to go looking through them. So,
well, you don't have an inventory either, right?
No. And okay. That's also part of it too. Like I'm trying to fill in, you know, complete runs and things like that. And it's just not possible. And I keep buying duplicates of things that I forget I have. You know, mm-hmm. It's a tough life.
It's a faulty system.
Well, I'm trying to rectify it. Mm-hmm. I'm doing the best I can.
What are you doing this weekend?
By the time people hear this, probably, I will be at Wizards World Portland.
That's adorable.
Yeah, which I'm looking forward to. And I'm also, you should be proud of me, I'm not particularly planning for.
I'm extremely proud of you.
Thank you.
I have it in writing that you don't have an agenda.
I don't have an agenda. I have some people I would like to meet that I haven't met before.
That's fine. That's not the same thing.
But I don't have a mass, like, I don't have the tagged, you know, box of comics to get signed and a list of who to see and when and that sort of thing.
And how's that working out for you?
That's fine.
You're stressed.
No, but the Vicodin has helped this week for me to not really have to think about that.
So are you still going to be on Vicodin over the weekend?
No, I think they cut me off.
Then you're going to be super stressed.
No,
you're going to get to the con and you're going to say, oh man, I don't have a plan. I don't know what to do. And you're probably going to blame me, which is fine. I'm used to it.
I will admit something. I do have a plan and an agenda. It's just not my normal one.
Okay.
Like, I'm more, right now, I'm kind of in a mode of collecting. So, in addition to, like, filling in, you know, runs of comics that I'm looking for, I've just got kind of a list of, like, first appearances that are still fairly affordable.
I saw that you picked up the first appearance of Cloak and Dagger today.
Yeah, that was a 50-cent find.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
That's one of the few things that I would be excited to have.
Well, I've got almost all the others. I just didn't have number one. And I was just looking through the 50-cent box at the store today after buying the new things, and that was one of the ones in there.
How have you not just bought all of the 50-cent comics already?
Well, a lot of them I know I have. And a lot of the ones like left over in that collection are stuff from like the 90s that I have plenty of.
Right.
And then some of them are ones that I'm not sure if I have or not. That's why I want to get organized and figure out what I'm missing and then go back through it and pull those
out.
But
like your shop must get a huge influx on a regular basis for it to be even worth it for you to go through the boxes.
This is the same collection they bought on whatever that was.
Back in November or something?
Was it Black Friday?
I feel like, yeah.
Yeah. So there's like 6 of those 18 long boxes still left of like the stuff that's left over after everyone's picked through. But there's still things like if I go through it every time, there might be like 1 or 2 or 3 things that I want to get. You know, if they're 50 cents, it's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's stuff like X-Force and X-Factor and, you know, X-Men and I guess a lot of X's, but, you know, Fantastic Four, like later, like 90s stuff that aren't really worth anything. A lot of people don't collect, but they'll fit into my runs and stuff that I want eventually. I'd rather pay 50 cents for it now than, you know, $1 or $2 most stores, you know.
Got it.
But I don't want to also buy another copy of a kind of unimportant issue and just have another copy of it.
Do you know I haven't been paying attention to any of the details about your collecting, like, saga for the past, 4-5 minutes now?
Yeah, I don't care. That's fine.
My eyes just glaze over. I think it's really lovely that you have this hobby that is separate from your enjoyment of reading, but, like, there is nothing about it that I can relate to at all.
Yeah, that's weird. I don't understand.
I venture to guess that more people fall on my end of the spectrum than yours.
Oh, I disagree.
Let me clarify. More people who are, how do I say this without being like a giant bitch?
I don't think that's possible.
I think that the impulsivity of collecting that is attractive to you is not an average compulsion.
Average in terms of your average comic book fan or average in terms of the populace?
Well, I don't know. That's when it starts to get a little dodgy, right? Because what is an average comic book fan these days?
I don't know, but here's the way I will say for collecting. Here's my maybe too old, and there's absolutely, you know, exceptions. This is more like a 60% true than a 100% true.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say most male comic book readers have a propensity to collect as well. And more than likely, a female comic book reader is not going to have that same desire to collect.
Okay.
And I think that's I don't know what that is, if that is societal or if that's biological, maybe a mixture of both. But I would say on average, men tend to collect things and like get into collections more than women do. Doesn't mean it's and I don't want to get into this, like, how I collect, you know, like...
No. We're not going to fight about this, because I don't have anything of that level that I would consider...
Right, and I know plenty of women that collect things and have collections.
Absolutely. And I know plenty of men who don't.
Right.
But, so I think that your point is interesting. I think that it's also generational. I think that you and I grew up at a time when speculation got a lot of attention, and I think that some of that has carried over to readers in their early to mid-30s,
yes,
who still have some of that that they're hanging on to from when we, like, were first exposed to comics.
I'm going to make you a long-term bet. I would say kids, like, 15, like, 13 to 18 right now.
Yeah.
In 10 to 15 years, the collector's market is going to, for comic books or whatever it is going to be bigger than ever.
You think so? Even,
yes.
Even with digital?
Especially. Because...
Oh, okay. Because more people are reading digital, and so they're... Okay.
Right. Because digital takes away the artifact aspect of it.
Sure.
And people like the tactile sense of owning something. Like, mm-hmm. You could read it digitally. You still want it if you're that kind of person. You want to have a copy of it.
I agree. That's why I still buy trades.
Mm-hmm.
But the scale of collecting that you are privy to is where I start to...
No, it's... I get way immersed in it, and I'll tend to, like, go in waves, you know?
Yeah. And so I'm just saying that is abnormal. That's not just buying and reading print like a lot of people do, and that's totally cool. It's... You get much more into the... You'd make the same separation that I just did between the collecting and the reading.
Sure.
And so that is something that I think is more unique than you acknowledge.
No, I acknowledge it because partly, too, like, my collecting habits have a lot, and, like, the cycles I go through have a lot to do with, like, my own stress levels, too.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, everything has to be an outlet for other stuff in your life, usually, at least for me. It's like,
yeah.
I'll get definitely more ramped up in collecting and hoarding or, you know, like, organizing, that sort of thing, as a stress relief if, you know, there's chaos and other stuff in my life.
I totally accept that. I'm very proud of you for acknowledging it.
Oh, I'm not an idiot.
My first introduction to the fantasy genre that I can remember, at least, came in early 2000 with the release of Final Fantasy IX. It was also the first time I really locked myself in a story and began to care for the characters on a more personal level. It made me laugh, made me cry, and more importantly, it acted as a gateway drug into the world of fantasy. Since then, I've discovered some of my favorite literary, cinematic, and comic-based works of fiction, and it is all thanks to a thief with a monkey tail. Travis McCollum, Talking Comics.
So, for your little inner child moment this week, since we're feeling so introspective, did you pick a book that is current, or did you pick one from years past that you recently acquired?
I picked one from years past.
Oh, okay. Well, each week I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants, and I've been very generous in allowing it to be something beyond just the pool from this current week. So whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply, 90 seconds, one book, one comic that we're not analyzing. Are you ready?
Yes.
Go.
Let's talk about Cloak and Dagger number one.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We can definitely talk about that.
Oh, okay. Thank you. That was I didn't know we were going to talk about it before when you brought it up, but that was my pick. Because Cloak and Dagger is a really fun series that has not really gotten its due yet. So number one was the one I was missing from, like, that main series. Like, they printed a bajillion of, like, the four-part miniseries,
right,
that, like, probably everyone has, or it's easy to find. And right, then they did an ongoing series after that, which I've got, like, 2 through 15 or something like that. So I came across number one today in the bin. I'm like, sweet. You know, that's the one I needed. And it's just a fun one to flip through. Like, I forget. They're a pretty cool, you know, superhero team.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they have a lot of involvement in, like, the Ultimate Universe, but that doesn't really count to me, you know? And they're popping up here and there in the regular Marvel Universe, but not as much as they should.
Are you excited about how they're going to appear in all new Ultimates?
Yeah, but that's still Ultimate Universe. That's the different. Sure, that's a different Cloak and Dagger.
Very different. Very different. But still, there's enough of a, like, hearkening back to the character dynamic that I'm pretty stoked.
Sure. I would like them to have more of an involvement in the main Marvel Universe, especially, like, they seem perfect for the new Avengers Initiative. Like, they should be showing up in, like, Avengers World or something like that, because they're a pretty powerful team. And they're, you know, they're that second-tier kind of level heroes that are what, you know, like, Stark and Captain America talk about.
You don't think it's possible that they will? Especially because...
I hope so.
They're going to be in the Ultimates title?
Yeah, we'll see. I hope so. It'd be nice. Yeah. So I.
By the way, you were over, way over. Like, the buzzer went off 15 seconds ago, but
whatever.
It's fine because I'm actually excited about this particular book that you picked up. So
great,
good job.
Thanks. So Cloak and Dagger number one.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about some new comic books?
Yes. Let's talk about new comics.
Okay.
Hey everybody, this is @CharmingRed on Twitter. I just have to say, there was never a time in my life where fantasy was not part of it. I had a brother who was 7 years older than me, so by the time I could even remember, fantasy was all around me in the form of comic books and role-playing games and miniatures and movies, and everything I touched had some form of fantasy a part of it because my brother and my parents loved it too. And of course, I naturally did as well. As far as comic books go, I think my favorite first fantasy comic that I ever really got into was Amethyst. And it was just a different world. It was a little girl who could immediately grow up and go and fight bad guys and have adventures. And as a little girl, I mean, that's just something you always automatically want to go ahead, just to go ahead and grow up and enjoy adventure.
Our first book this week is Umbral Number 3, written by Anthony Johnston and drawn by Christopher Mitten, with colors by Jordan Boyd and lettering by Thomas Maurer. Umbral is published by Image Comics.
Okay, from the solicit, which is full of enthusiasm and exclamation marks, a new dark fantasy from the creators of Wasteland. The young thief called Rascal witnesses the horrific murder of the royal family. Now the world's dark legends will be relived, and only Rascal even knows it's happening. Nightmare shadow creatures, murdered kings, slaughtered smugglers, mysterious hobos, mythical gems, and stone guardians. It can only be Umbral, the incredibly rich new fantasy world from Wasteland creators Anthony Johnston and Christopher Mitten. Join Rascal as she fights to uncover the truth and to stay alive. So, like, really, that joyous punctuation and the combination of the words dark fantasy and murder is, like, hilarious to me.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I am liking this more and more with every issue. And yeah. I liked it from the first issue, and it's just growing on me more and more. You know, I think fantasy worlds especially take, to do them right, they take a while to grow.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is starting, it started out tight and compressed, and you find out all these crazy things that are going on, but now you're finding out more about this bigger world that they're in and what's at stake. I try to think about, like, what it reminds me of, and there's definitely certain things, but at the same time, nothing, like, comes to mind, you know?
Yeah, it has a lot of the tropes that I associate with, like, I'm gonna get nailed for this terminology, but traditional fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even, there's a map at the beginning of the first issue, mm-hmm. which the creators even joked about. But I've been thinking a lot about, because we asked everyone what their first introduction to fantasy was, and I've been thinking a lot about that for myself, because it's been a type of story that I've really gravitated to for, like, most of my life.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out why that is and what is appealing to me. This reminds me of a lot of things, but that's not bad. That I think that just means that it's pretty solidly rooted in the genre. There are recognizable moments and reveals and, you know, character types that feel familiar, but that's on purpose.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's interesting that because this is a dark fantasy and like whatever that means on top of everything else, the Johnston actually wrote about how the design, the character design for the Umbral was based on like those shadow monsters that you see as you're falling asleep at night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, of course I can relate to that. I mean, that's a very physical manifestation of my experience of being afraid of the dark as an adult. Mm. Like, of course everybody understands that kind of shadow monster terror, but there's nothing about this book that is terrifying to me. And so I've been thinking about also like fantasy for me is, it's like two levels removed from real. And so monsters in fantasy stories have never been scary.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if there's a ghost in a fantantasy book, I'm not afraid of it.
Because not only it's like it's right? It because you know it's fake or something.
It's like extra fake.
Huh.
And yet it very much fulfills like my own like sick desire to read stories that have those types of like thrills in them. You know, because like I enjoy that type of story, even though it terrifies me.
Hmm.
And so if you plop it down in a fantastical environment, then I can get into it more because I'm, I don't know, more immune to like my like personal projection of my fear.
Uh-huh.
And I can just enjoy it as a storytelling device.
Okay. I can see that. Sure. can we step back a minute, because I'm curious actually this week, what is your answer to our question?
Oh gosh. Man, I didn't think about that in a way that I could articulate quickly. Hmm. I've certainly got a list of
things I couldn't tell you
are very early.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you what my first one was, but I could tell you like what one of my like strongest memories is.
Yeah.
For me it probably would have been Neverending Story.
The movie?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, I know I'm sure there's plenty of books and stuff mm-hmm. I read beforehand, but I usually go with, like, when I think of something, what comes to mind first? And I watched that movie, you know, 100 times as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, like, one of those, like, really strong cementing movies for fantasy, you know, genre.
Sure.
That I, you know, still will think about. Like, it's such a perfect kind of, you know, representation of that.
See, I did a lot more reading as a kid than any of those more typical fantasy movies. I blitzed through all of the Terry Brooks books and
Piers Anthony,
some but not all of them. Mercedes Lackey.
Uh-huh.
I got really interested in fantasy tropes that were transported into modern times. I mean, like elves as a character type and like how they would behave in like modern day, I thought was really interesting.
Mm.
Like once I went through all of the more traditional fantasy, I also, and this relates to Umbral, the character type, like the thief character is something that I think from the very, very beginning was also super appealing to me. Like that rogue, I mean, how unsurprising is that? But I think, honestly, that goes back to Robin Hood.
Okay. Yeah, sure. That, I was going to say Dungeons & Dragons or something, but yeah.
No, way before that. Definitely way before that. And so anytime you have that kind of outsider, thief-like character, thief assassin, like whatever, that was the voice that I was always interested in hearing from, because it was an outsider within a world that was full of outsiders.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, and we're going to talk about ElfQuest, but definitely ElfQuest was the first fantasy graphic novel that I ever experienced. And I got really into that because it was visual.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I didn't see as many of the movies. I did a bunch of the reading, but it was the first time that some of those like story conventions in a fantasy universe were actually like drawn for me.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, that is usually a very good way of introducing people, kids, to a particular type of genre too.
Yeah. But I think that I come at my analysis of it from a very like poor man's perspective. Like it is 100% anecdotal. I have never taken any kind of like serious science fiction or fantasy literature analysis class.
I think that almost in a way kind of overanalyzing it in that way sort of removes the wonder of the genre too.
I don't know. I don't think so. I think that looking at the common themes and then like obviously tracing it back to like the historical and cultural context of when the works were written is very illuminating, but like that's just me.
Yeah, I don't know, some stuff I especially when it's like more with movies than books, like we've talked about this, I don't want to see or pick apart how it's made, you know.
Right.
I'd rather just enjoy the work for the work,
right?
And especially sci-fi and fantasy. Because if I start thinking about the practicality or the possibility of a lot of things or the motivations for writing it or, you know, other stuff, it can detract for me from the wonder of the world that's created.
Well, I'm sad for you because I think that that's part of the fun.
I disagree.
Unsurprisingly.
So let's move on.
Well, a couple more things about Umbral first.
Fine.
It's interesting that Rascal, our little thief character, is female. I think that's clearly a conscious choice and not something that is specific to this genre, but this like adventuring solitary character who happens to be female, we're seeing more and more. And so there's a vulnerability there with her like role in this kind of bigger like fantastical saga that could be fun to explore.
Sure. Yeah.
I have to say that though, with the like acknowledgement that typically that is a huge turnoff for me in any kind of fantasy story.
Hmm.
That I want like a male lead protagonist. And that has been true since I was a kid. And it's probably because of the kinds of books that I was reading and that most of those lead characters happen to be male. But that's true in ElfQuest also, that all of the characters that I was interested in hearing the stories about and from were male. And the female characters were interesting, but secondarily so. So in contrast, I think Rascal, probably because she's younger, and there's not so much like girlness about her so far, that she comes across as like she could have been any probably like teenage, like naive, thiefy kind of character. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that she is female is fine. And in fact, could be a device that I can get behind moving forward. But I just have to kind of put it out there that normally, for some reason, in this genre, I'm like pretty much team boy.
Huh. That is interesting, and I don't feel really one way or the other. I think I probably felt younger, when I was younger, that I would want to read about a male protagonist because I would more strongly identify with the like characters I was reading. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want to like imagine yourself as the, you know, the hero.
Right.
But I don't think it doesn't really matter to me.
I wasn't reading as many obvious hero stories.
Okay.
Like I just said that the character type that I am the most attracted to is like that kind of brigand, thief, rogue, assassin, blah, blah, blah. Like that's not the hero ever.
Oh, I don't know. I think in most of those books, though, that rogue, thief, assassin guy is, he's sort of the, you know, he's the guy who doesn't seem, he's the unlikely hero. Who
right,
proves
that's
his
a
worth.
Totally different character type than hero.
Yeah, but it is the hero who proves himself to be in the end.
Right. I guess I'm just making the distinction that like it's not the leader, it's not the like prince, it's not the you know, golden boy.
Right.
And so it's less about relating to the character and more about appreciating the character's journey.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Okay.
Well, you want to talk about ElfQuest now?
Yeah, let's talk about another journey.
Oddly enough, my first introduction to the fantasy genre was the NES game Final Fantasy. My brother and I pooled our Christmas money together to get a new video game. Even though we'd never heard of it, we thought we'd get it anyway. We stayed up for hours playing that game and eventually beat it. We then got each sequel, even getting the PlayStation when they got the Final Fantasy license. Some of my favorite childhood memories.
Our second book is ElfQuest, The Final Quest, number one, written by Wendy and Richard Peeney, with art by Wendy Peeney and coloring by Sunny Street. Lettering is by Nate Pikos of Blambot. ElfQuest is published by Dark Horse Comics.
Are there any other question marks that you want to add to the script there?
I don't think so. I think I did an okay job with those names.
Some nice upspeak. So there's a really lovely letter from Richard Peeney in the front of this issue, acknowledging that ElfQuest has been around for 35 years, and yet it's still often mistaken for like a cute fantasy comic. So I want to actually read part of that letter. ElfQuest is the story of the Wolfriders, and they are elves, but not the stately creatures of Tolkien, nor the jolly toy makers who help Santa Claus. This forest-dwelling tribe, Chief Cutter, Stargazer Skywise, Huntress Nightfall, and her gentle mate Redlance, and all the rest, are a scrappy, feral lot. They hunt by night, they survive against humans who hate them, cave trolls who try to rob them, and magically spawned monsters that live only to destroy. The Wolfriders have one grand goal, to find the legendary home of their ancestors, the mythic Palace of the High Ones. Along the way, they've discovered that their primitive and deadly world is stranger than they imagined, and they found other tribes of elves, immortal desert dwellers, decadent inhabitants of a hollow mountain, stag-riding warriors of the frozen Northlands who, if nothing else, know how to party hardy before going to battle. These are the elves you've never experienced before. Bottom line, ElfQuest is a story that, even though it's fantasy, is about real life. Our lives. Maybe yours, too. Readers have said that the saga of the Wolfriders transformed them. We bet once you've given ElfQuest a try, you'll discover that its blend of grand adventure and quiet intimacy, triumph and sorrow, sensuality and innocence, will speak to you as no other comic book series ever has. And even though there's much that's gone before, now's the perfect time to jump on in, as the Wolfriders embark on their latest and most momentous adventure, Final Quest. So it's a little bit of PR speak, but I think that when you have a series that's been around for 35 years and characters that have been a part of people's lives, like literally as they're growing up, I think you're entitled
sure.
to kind of look back and say, yeah, this is, there's some weight behind this.
Yeah. What was your first kind of exposure to ElfQuest?
There was a bookstore that I used to go to, and then I ultimately started working at, that was a combination of new things and then used books.
Mm-hmm.
And he carried the graphic novels, like Mittendrinnen. So I picked up the first couple, and I was probably, 12.
Oh, okay.
11 or 12. It was not a whole lot after I started reading other comics. So, certainly no older than 13.
Okay.
And they were the big, beautiful, bound, full-color ones.
Yeah, yeah. The volumes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had, a whole huge stack of them that subsequently were, stolen from a creepy guy I dated in high school, but that's a different story.
Okay. He has cool taste in comics, though.
I don't know. Maybe he was selling them for drugs. It's really unclear at this point. But
okay.
the attraction to me was the immersion in this world that was so fucking huge. And because at that point, so many of them had already been published. So yes, I was starting at the beginning, but I knew that there was so much more to come.
Mm-hmm.
And so the appeal of the potential journey was great. And like I said, the visual depiction of things that I had kind of been getting into reading more in prose was also really exciting. And so I think that, like, Wendy Pini's art style had a big influence on how I visualized some of those types of characters in other media, like other non-visual media,
mm-hmm.
but predominantly prose, because it was one of the first that I really, like, got into. There is also absolutely no way that my mom had any idea about some of the content.
Right.
Like, there's a lot of sex in ElfQuest.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of like, fairly complicated relationship pairings and sometimes triads. And, you know, it's pretty much anything goes. Sex for fun and sex for procreation are not the same. And so that was also, that's how I know kind of roughly when or how old I was, because it was a little bit early in some regards for some of those themes.
Yeah. I was probably 13 as well. I think it was right before high school. I got like the first four of those, you know, collected volumes.
Right, right.
And I traded a kid at school for them for, like, some, like, Game Boy games.
Well, that's probably what my ex-boyfriend did. He probably just traded them for drugs. It was totally cool.
Okay, maybe. Probably not the same guy.
Probably not.
No, but regardless, I'm pretty sure that's what I traded for. And that was, like, my first, I think those were, like, the first, like, big, like, solid run of a comic book that I ever got.
Yeah.
You know, like, whereas I wasn't getting, like, an issue here and there every, like, 4 or 5 months or something.
Agreed.
So I had, like, an actual storyline to read.
Mm-hmm.
And
as opposed to, like, you know, the essential Calvin and Hobbes or something.
Well, that,
a little bit more benign.
Different. Yeah, totally different. Different. Like, that's comics, but that's a different type of comics. Or, like, you know, just getting a G.I. Joe every, you know, 4 months or something.
Please school me on the difference between a collected graphic novel type format and, you know, Sunday comics.
I don't know what you know or what you don't know. It's like
anyway.
I'm trying to talk to a foreigner here.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I mean, I had basically...
Oh my God, that was the perfect opportunity for an inner circle joke and I completely missed it.
Yep, can't go back now.
Continue.
So, I don't really have a ton more to add than what you said, because it's a lot of it was the same for me too. Like, you know, that what goes on in the comic, that dynamics, the family dynamics, the
mm-hmm.
the social dynamics of the tribe really mimic a lot of what would happen in our own society. But the fantasy aspect of it too is like that. It's at the same time, like, I was getting into, like, Dungeons and Dragons and things too. So they kind of, you know, go kind of hand in hand.
Right.
And that was a big push for me. But this would have been like early 90s, like late 80s or early 90s,
right,
you know,
right,
where a lot of the stuff, like the heyday, I think, for that was like mid 70s to mid 80s.
For what?
I think fantasy had a really big resurgence in that time.
Oh, sure.
You know, sure. That was kind of like a golden age of a fantasy for that time, where it was... not falling out of favor, but definitely didn't have as much momentum as it did, you know, in the decade mm-hmm. before. But at least it was easy and accessible. And I definitely grew up with a group of people that were really into it too. So, like, it was naturally, it's sort of like a primer for everything else that I got into in high school and, you know, after.
So I didn't go back and look at any of the older books that I have. And like I said, I think I only have maybe 2 or 3 remaining and not even like the first 3. So I did zero prep except to just pick up this first issue. And I'm curious if you thought that it was accessible for new and or returning readers to this like fantasy world.
I think so. I think you have to want to get into it
mm-hmm.
because there is, it's both, there's a lot of history there, but it's also a self-contained story where you can learn these characters, you know, brand new as well.
Right.
You know, a lot of stories are written like, here's what's going on. The people will talk to each other as they know each other.
Mm-hmm.
And your expectation as the reader is just to learn who they are through the journey.
Yeah, there was a lot of vocabulary, I thought. which is not a bad thing necessarily, but enough that I stopped to look things up a couple of times to just remind myself, like, what are the rules of this world and what am I remembering versus what have I lost? And I didn't mind that because it was like comforting that things are still pretty much the same.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about this because it is kind of nifty to return to something that was like such an essential part of my indoctrination into fantasy, like as a like story type. But I can see how this is not for everybody.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's not something like everyone has to go out and read because there is the burden of all that history.
It's also dated.
It is dated.
It's an older kind of fantasy storytelling than like Umbral, for example.
Right. Absolutely. But that's kind of fun to return to every once in a while.
Sure. It's a bit like reading, I don't know, like Silver Age comics or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a style choice to the way that the, you know, characters interact and even like the art itself, which is still like lovely, but it is, I wish that there was a way to say dated without it sounding like a dismissal because I'm not doing that. But I think I'm just making the distinction between we had two very different kinds of fantasy books this week. And yet I think that they both can be very proud examples within that genre.
Yeah. I agree. I think this is a good dichotomy of the same genre written in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And we definitely have history with it, so it appeals to us more than I think a 20-year-old kid who's never looked at, you know, Elfquest would read it.
Man, that nostalgia, that'll get you every time.
Just gets worse and worse as you get older and older. Well,
fair enough.
Talking about nostalgia, do you want to talk to Josh Williamson?
That was a terrible transition.
Yeah.
Again.
That's my thing now. I've embraced it.
Yeah. Terrible transitions and mispronunciation.
That is what I am known for.
Those
are two of the rules of the inner circle.
Oh my fucking God. Okay. Bring it on.
All right.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Andrea. Jason Sachs at Jason Sachs SACKS on the Twitter. I'm calling about this week's nerd confession. Which is what was your first introduction to the fantasy genre? So, when I was about, third or fourth grade, we lived in a large house out in the country in a town called Cooperstown, New York. And while we lived there, we had this, one area of the house had this beautiful blazing fireplace in the wintertime. We'd actually pile wood into the fireplace and, just have a wonderful space where you could sit and read as much as you wanted. And one of my happiest memories of those years was my parents recommending I read first The Hobbit and then The Lord of the Rings. So my introduction to the fantasy genre was sitting in front of a blazing fire on a cold, cold winter's day, delving into the world of J.R.R. Tolkien. Yeah, it was a little hard. The words were a bit strange, and the universe was kind of bizarre. But, you know, I'd been reading comics for years by that point, and it wasn't really that weird for me. It was more just awesome. So thanks for bringing back good memories. I miss that old house. I remember having a lot of really good times there. Thanks. Great show. Talk to you later.
This week on The Couch, we welcome writer Joshua Williamson. Joshua is currently writing Ghosted, published by Image Comics, Masks and Mobsters, published digitally by Monkey Brain, and in a hardcover collection by Image, and Captain Midnight, published by Dark Horse Comics. He's also written for DC Comics and Marvel, and his upcoming series Nailbiter was announced at Image Expo 2 weeks ago. Thanks for joining us, Josh.
No problem, man. I'm glad to come and talk to you guys.
Yeah.
See, so, I just saw you guys.
It's true.
I know, but... It's good to talk without, we were like, you know, surrounded by audio equipment and like crazy hiding in a dressing room, and it was weird. This is this is so much more normal to just talk isolated in three different spaces without actually having to interact.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was a weird day. Like, that was a funny thing. I mean, I don't know if I think I told you guys when I was there that, like, I don't really leave my house much. So,
oh, really?
You know, so, like, that whole thing is weird. That's why that took me, like, a week to recover from, because that was such an intense 2 days of just, like, tension and stuff that it kind of froze my brain a little bit when I got back. So it took me a minute to get over it.
Yeah, that was, for me, it was pretty exhausting. I can only imagine for you what it was like.
Well, I told you what happened, right? Like, I didn't know we were announcing the book until I got there. Did we talk about that?
No.
Like, I kind of, so what happened was, like, about a month before, they told me that they weren't going to announce it.
But they still wanted you to come, though?
Well, I was going no matter what. Okay. I wanted to go. I have this weird thing where I actually like comic books. So
right.
I was like, I want to go. I want to go. I like comics. And I went to the first one 2 years ago. And I did not go to the one in June. I haven't gotten any since then.
Mm.
And I really wanted to go again. So I knew I was going to go before that. Like, I basically, once I found out about it, I knew ahead of time. But once it was official, I was like, I bought my plane ticket. I'm like, I'm going no matter what. And they told me, oh, we're not announcing the Elvira. I was like, okay, that's fine. And then, like, a few days before, they were like, oh, we think we're announcing it. And I was like, well, what's going on? And they weren't sure. And then so I got down there, and I was, like, just hanging out in the front with everybody else, just, like, hanging out with my friends that were going. And they came up to me, and they're like, hey, you need to get to the back right now. Like, we need to prep you and get ready. And I'm like, ready for what? What are we doing? And so we get to the back, and I mean, it was really awesome because I knew some friends were going to be there and some of them I didn't. And so I walked in the back. So I was in the back, and I was talking to Scott Snyder, and he was like, so what are you going to say? And I'm like, oh, nothing. I'm not saying anything. Like, I'm not going up on stage. Like, they're doing that. Like, I think Eric's going to, like, do a run-through of, like, a bunch of the books they're announcing, like he did with Ghosted last year. And I think that they're only going to announce the really, really big books today. And then Ron comes back and is like, oh, here's your numbers, and here's what you're doing. And I was like, what?
Wow.
What are we doing? So, that's the thing I told people. Like, I was really glad people were really happy with my presentation because I winged it. Like, I had no idea what was happening.
You were solid. You were very articulate. I'm not just giving you, like, lip about it. I was impressed.
Thanks. That's, I usually do pretty good on my feet. So, I think that's what it is with Ghosted. Like, I have the heart of a con artist. And I think that, you know, that's what, like with Jackson, like I just kind of think that's why I think I'm able to write Jackson so easily.
maybe it was all planned on like Ron's part. Like, we're not going to tell him he's coming up on stage. We're just going to throw him into it because that's how he does. That's what he does really well.
I don't think Ron knows me that well.
Okay.
So you know, I went up and did it. It was really cool because Valentino. I've known Valentino for a long time now. I feel like a really long time now. He's kind of one of my mentors. So when I was done walking out the stage, he gave me a thumbs up, and so did Ron. I was like, I guess I did all right, you know?
Nice.
So I didn't know what was going on.
That was a huge announcement. Obviously, it was probably really exciting in contrast to, like, just being part of the rundown with Ghosted to actually be able to get up and present, like, even off the cuff. So we're obviously then going to talk more about Nailbiter and Ghosted, but I'm curious if you have anything else, like other projects up your sleeve that you can taunt us with now or anything else that you're working on that you can at least allude to.
I'm doing a few different things, but it's too soon to talk about it, I guess. Like, I mean, cool. You know, I know Predator, like Predator is coming out this summer. I'm not really sure right now. I think it might be July, but it might be pushed back. I'm not sure. And I am doing more Image stuff, and I think we're announcing some other things soon, but it's right, so early to talk about. Like, I'm doing this other one that's, it's really weird because, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine we were talking about Nailbiter. I'm talking to Joe Keating. So I say friend of mine, Joe Keating.
Sure.
Like, Joe Keating and I were talking. He lives here in town and we hang out. Like, I went and had lunch with him and Valentino yesterday. And we were talking about, you know, all this stuff about typecasting. We were talking about how with Ghosted and Nailbiter, they're both horror, and Predator, to an extent, is horror, like sci-fi horror. Was I worried about getting typecasted? And I was like, no, because, and I'm also, there is another horror book, like, there's like two more horror books down the line. And he's like, are you worried about being typecast? I was like, no, because this other book I'm working on, which I feel like is the biggest book I've done, is not horror at all.
Hmm.
There are some moments of fear. I mean, everything, you have to have tension, you know, you have to have a little tension in your books, but It's not horror at all. It's much more of a, I don't know the right word for it. I'm going to say fantasy, but not really. but that's coming on the line. And that one is much more of a, it's funny because you guys are, you know, therapy and all that. Like, that one's much more of a psychological comic. It's much more of a family therapy thing. It's funny because there's a lot of, like, my own personal sort of, like, neuroses are going into that one, you know? And so it'll be interesting to see what people think of that one, because it's not horror at all. So I'm very curious if people are going to be like, I would not call it horror. There's definitely a scary part in the beginning, you know, like there has to be, and there's some stuff throughout, but...
well, it's kind of interesting horror. That, like, you know, I know, some writers don't care if they're typecast because they like to write a certain type of book, and that's what they're good at. And others, it seems like maybe newer ones, it's the same, like, with, you know, actors or something like that. They want to have a wide net. And I think we even talked maybe about this with, like, Paul Tobin, too.
Yeah,
like, we touched
definitely.
On that. Like, you know, trying to hit different genres because they don't want to be known as, you don't want to be known as the something guy.
Yeah, Paul likes to do everything.
Yeah.
Because Paul's a friend of mine. He likes to do everything. He has no discerning thing about genre at all.
Right.
I don't know. I was like that before. I disagree with Paul on that in some instances. I was like that before. But then I was just kind of unhappy about a lot of stuff I was doing. Like, I felt like I was kind of throwing things at the wall. And don't get me wrong. There was a lot of stuff I was happy working on. But I started just realizing, like, when I was working on Ghosted. And I was working on Ghosted for so long that I realized I was the happiest working on that. And now, whenever I work on that, like, it's just, it flows so easily. And it's the same with Nailbiter. And some of the books I'm doing now, I just... I don't know. This is not really strange, but is Vertigo a genre? You know, it's like,
it definitely has a feel to it. Like, people expect a certain type of, like, a book to fall in with a certain sort of feeling, I guess, is the best way to describe a Vertigo book.
I feel like that's the theme that I like to write in. Is sort of that. I don't know. It's sort of like Captain Midnight. Like, I wish they would let me get away with more of Captain Midnight. I mean, I'm happy with that book, but there are times I wish I could get away with a little bit more. I try
and I would say
stuff.
Captain Midnight is not at all a horror book. It's pulp,
no,
you know, it's pulp, exciting,
totally.
Action.
Yeah, with that book, I had to find things to make it work for me. And really doing pulp was sort of the way of doing it. Because if it was just straight action with none of the pulpiness of it, none of the, like, even conspiracy sort of thing of it, I would have a harder time with it.
Yeah, I can see that.
But with that, you know, I was able to make it work. What you were saying before, earlier, about the Nailbiter announcement, like, yeah, it was pretty big. Like, it was a weird, surreal moment. You know, just kind of, like, being there and going out on stage and talking about the comic and then the press from it. There's no way I would have gotten... I don't think any book I've ever done has gotten that much press on announcement, like, at all, you know? So...
Well, Image Expo got a ton of coverage.
Yeah, it's crazy. I didn't know until I got home. You know, like, I think I might have told you guys this, but, like...
I think I saw you tweet it, like, you're like, oh, I just looked at my email, holy crap.
The thing was, is that it felt like, you know, when you're looking at emails on your phone, all you're seeing are the trees, like, you have no grasp of the forest at all.
Yeah.
And so when I got home, I looked at the forest, and I was like, holy crap, like, I'm never going to catch up. And I'm still behind right now. Coming out of Injection was really weird because all of a sudden I got, like, a million of, like, can you help me emails and stuff like that. And so that was kind of a surreal thing. And some people I had been talking to for a while were helping them. I was like, totally thankful to help them. But, like, people were coming out of the woodwork. And my email is public. So I was getting, like, attacked.
Well, I think that's why, like, guys like, you see guys like Rucka or Bendis, like, you can't find their public emails because they probably just get inundated with that stuff. You know,
Bendis has a public email that he's used since the probably 99, since the early Powers days. But that is not his. I don't know how that works. It's really weird. I don't think it's his actual work email.
It can't. It would just get drowned with stuff.
Well, I think he has a system. obviously he has a system.
Yeah.
But yeah, he has this public email that he's had forever. And I remember when I was in his class. So when I went to go take Brian's class at PSU, you had to, not only did you have to go and register for the class, all this stuff, you had to get his approval.
Huh.
And when you had to email him for his approval, it was a special email that they set up.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, when I emailed that email, the email that I got back was from his public email.
Oh, interesting.
And so I know he uses it for a lot. So we were in class at that point. We weren't even using his. I wasn't even using his class email at that point. I was just using the public email. He responds, you know. But I imagine when it comes to like actual Marvel and DC editorial stuff, or not DC, yeah, when it's Marvel stuff.
Wow, you're revealing something here.
No, I'm not at all. Not even close. Yeah, it's funny. I joke around with this with other people, but you know, 5 years ago, I would have been begging people to email me back.
Right.
You know, and now I'm gonna be like, how about you not email me back for like a week?
Yeah.
Like, give me some time here. We like Dustin Nguyen and I are buddies, and I've known him since 2000, and we were 2001. But we have we were both kind of in different studios of guys trying to work in comics, and he had already broke in. He was a couple years ahead of me. He was already doing Wildcats. Like, Wildcats even been announced yet.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Wildcats even announced it. He just got the job, and all he had was like a few pages and some covers.
But he did Wildcats like volume 3 or something.
3.0. Yeah. So he had just got that job, and I was still doing mini comics. But we both had like guys we hung out with all the time that were trying to break in. And it was such a weird, you know, we both look back at it, and I was just talking about this from last night. We were talking about our workloads, and I was just like, oh man, like I'm buried. And he was sort of saying the same thing, and he was like, man, listen to us. Like, you know, if we went back in time to 2001 and talked to the guys, then they'd be like, shut up. Like, you should be thankful.
Right. It's careful what you wish for, but I mean, this is the problem you want to have as a comics creator.
Yeah.
Feast or famine.
Yeah, I know. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. I always look at Brian K. Vaughan a lot, though. Like, I think a lot about Brian K. Vaughan and Garth Ennis and sort of how they've done their careers and sort of, like, how they haven't done that many books. There was a time when BKV was doing a lot, but then you look at, I think since Why the Last Man came out.
He broke through.
It down.
Yeah, but he broke through. He made so much money from, like, you know, Ex Machina and Why, especially, that it's like he got to then sit back and pick his projects.
Yeah, that's the goal. I think that's the... Then the Garth Ennis. But you have to imagine how young those guys were, too. I mean, you're talking... They're both... I think they were both, like, 24. So Why the Last Man hit when he was 24, and same thing with Preacher. I think Garth Ennis was 24.
Well, so, I mean, even go back further. Look at, like, the original Image guys, you know? Like, how young they were when Image exploded.
They weren't that young. A lot of those guys were in their 30s.
Was Liefeld even that old?
Liefeld was a little older. Liefeld was the youngest of that group. But think about it, like, so those guys are already kids, you know? Like, that's why in the documentary, I think in the picture, there's a shot of Valentino with his son. I mean,
yeah. Well, I know.
Like, I think that was his
son. I know Jim was older, yeah.
Yeah, Jim was older. I don't know how the rest, I mean, some of those guys were in their 30s.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't, you know.
That's not old.
I'm in my 30s, so I understand, but I'm just saying, like.
Right. There's at least in your 30s, like, you're not a child anymore. Like, you can kind of handle that. Like, if you're 24, 25, like, you just don't have a grasp of, like, you know, if you're suddenly a millionaire, that's a very different thing.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. My girlfriend and I have this conversation occasionally because she's a little bit younger than I am. And I'll think about how, like, my brother or whoever or like, other people we know who are younger. And I'm like, man, I remember being 26 and I had nothing together. Yeah. And so when I meet people who are 26, I'm like, man, you guys got it made. I don't know what you guys are doing different. But when I was 26, I was still in my idiot mode, I feel like. I was still making comics then. Like, I was doing, like, mini stuff here and there. But I wasn't doing, like, what I'm doing now, you know? Like, yeah. I was doing, like, I was lucky if I did a few comics a year compared to now.
But that's, like, part of it, though, too. Don't you have to go through that? Yeah. You know, that's part of developing yourself as a writer and a creator. Like, you do that, you know, the little mini comics. That's sort of developing your voice and what you like, and you figure it out from there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of weird. Like, there's two things to this. Like, I always feel like I am sort of one of those people that I'm definitely the tortoise. You know, I'm the tortoise in the Tortoise and the Hare story. And it takes me a while. And sometimes I have to get hit in the head to sort of figure it out. And that was kind of like what 2011 was for me. And part 2012 was a little bit of that, was kind of getting hit in the head a few times, mm-hmm. and then being like, oh, I should be doing this. And I was already working on Ghosted then, and I knew that was the kind of book I wanted to do. And I just knew at the time, like, that was the kind of books I wanted to do, and that was the voice, and that was sort of the stuff, and needed to start slowly getting away from the other things I was doing that weren't along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality of work just needed to improve on my part. Like, I just needed to be better and stop pumping stuff out so quickly. And mm-hmm. so now it's, you know, it took time, but, like, where I'm at now, I'm much happier with, obviously. But that's what comes with experience, you know? Like, it's mm-hmm. Robert Kirkman wrote this thing years ago on CBR that was called, it was over his, whatever his column was, but there was one particular one that was called, You Probably Suck. And it was about, like, when you're first starting out, like, you probably suck. Like, more than likely you're not good. But that doesn't mean you're not going to be good a couple years from now. It means that right now you're probably not good. You probably suck. You got to get better. And I believe that. Like, every time I did a comic, I would look at it and be like, I could do better than that. I could fix that. Or I go, oh, man, I didn't even realize that. I could do this and this and this. And I think that's one of the best ways to learn about pacing. It sucks that it's kind of like that. But it's like every time you make a new comic, you look at the pacing of it. And you're like, wow, I could have probably done that scene in less pages. Or I probably could have done it in more pages. It would have been better. You start learning more about the economy of the page as you go.
But and that's, you know, that's the back side of it. It doesn't necessarily mean that the reader will get that deep into, you know, the execution of the story. It's good for you as the creator to refine and hone your craft, you know, with every issue.
Yeah, they're not seeing it the same way because we're seeing it from. It's really weird because when you comic people, when they get, it's like they, when you've got reviewers or just readers, they're reading so much and it's so much of a variety and so much changes of things that it's like, it isn't as personal for them because you didn't write it. Like when you're writing it, you're seeing your own work repeatedly in so many different stages and you're so in it and you're so far ahead of them in a way, like in terms of what you are working on, that you just kind of see it from a different viewpoint. It's a weird like way of going about things, I guess.
No, that's all. Absolutely. It kind of leads me into my next question about like influences, you know, I don't want to talk, you know, because we already kind of talked about getting pigeonholed into a certain type of genre you know, as a certain type of writer. But I think talking to you, you're very interested in like crime fiction, you know, noir and action and, you know, stuff now with Nailbiter and serial killers. Like, did you grow up reading kind of stuff? Like what's, even if it's now, like what in the past has influenced, you know, these stories now?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think influence is such a weird thing because there are books that I liked. It's funny how you go through three stages of influence where it's like, the people you liked when you were younger, the people that have actually like taught you stuff, and the people you I don't want to use idolize, but emulate, I suppose.
Sure.
So you know, when I was young, I was really into like Mark Waid and Peter David. They were the guys that I really looked up to and sort of thought were like these amazing writers. And then eventually Grant Morrison. And then people I'm influenced by, like I'm always ripping on Brubaker and Garth Ennis and Brian K. Vaughan. Like, those are the three that I know. And a little Rick Remender. Like, I know those are guys that I like. Like, Rick Remender has a really strong handle on pacing. Yeah. And so I've always sort of, like, read his comics and counted how many panels were on the page and how much, what was going on. But, yeah, and even Joe Hill, to an extent, with Lock and Key. His pacing is completely different from mine, but he has an ability to add tension that I find very interesting.
Yeah,
but
especially in Lock and Key.
In Lock and Key, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
but those are all comics. Did you have other?
It's not comics.
I mean, especially in terms of, I don't know, like crime stories or ghost stories or things like that you read more when you were younger that have developed or influenced your tastes now.
Do you remember or did you ever read Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark?
Yeah, yeah.
That is a huge one. On me and sort of my thing of horror, where I sort of always been interested in sort of like the true story behind horror.
Yeah. Oh man, that's the kind of stuff I fucking love that. Yeah.
Remember back, so if you would buy that in the back, he would always have like the explanations or the history.
Right.
I used to love that part. Like that was the part that I would eat up, and I'm still like that now. When I hear someone tell a horror story, like I want to know that they're part of it. Like, you know, there's that Cropsey documentary on Netflix. Like, I find that to be very interesting and sort of like, I'm obsessed with documentaries about horror movies because there's always some kind of like weird story behind it. So like with John Carpenter with Halloween, there's a really good documentary on that. Science of the Lambs is always really interesting to me because of how much stuff they went, you know, Richard Harris went through when he was writing Science of the Lambs. Because, you know, if you think about how he, or Thomas Harris, sorry, not Richard Harris, Thomas Harris, you know, he went to the feds and went to the profilers when they were first starting out. Like, they had just opened that stuff up. They were really just learning about profiling. and sort of started asking questions. Like, I think that's interesting. Like, he went and did all that back then. Like, now it's so commonplace. And actually now with profiling, there isn't really a profiling department anymore. There isn't a job. Like, there isn't a profiler job anymore because all agents are trained to become profilers as they're going through. But back then, like, that was so brand new. And, you know, Harris was able to go and sort of absorb that. But, yeah, so Silence of the Lambs is a big one for me. Psycho is huge. Shining. Books and movies of all these things. but yeah, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is, like, I think the earliest thing that will always stick with me. And
Those are the ones that had the really amazing illustrations, too.
Yeah. Like, and
some of the pictures were just so... They're scarier for me, just visually, than some of the stories were.
Yeah, there's that story where it's the girl gets a spider bite on her cheek. Do you remember that one?
Yes. Ah, yes.
Yeah. So here's the thing about that. I'm going to tell you something about that story. I remember that story really well, and I could tell a story to people. And you know, that's the thing about that book that's amazing, is it's really just folklore, right? Like, it's just...
Right.
He's just sort of, like, passing... It's another form of passing on folklore. But I remember thinking that story must have been, like, 10 pages long. And I went and when I was looking at the book recently, it's like a page. It's like not even a page. It's a page and then the art. You know, that's it. And it's such a awesome thing. It sucks.
Yeah. It's so visceral, too. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know that when Scholastic went and did a re-release about, I want to say 10 years ago, they did all new art for it?
What? No.
Yeah. So now if you go to buy it, you have to go and find the originals from the 80s to try to... buy it. So I actually was able to find, I couldn't find mine. Mine are probably in a box somewhere, tore up. So I was able to go to Powell's up here in Portland to find the original book and was able to sort of start digging into that. And have been reading that for a while, and it's awesome. So that's probably the beginning of me with horror. Crime but, stuff. Well, go ahead. What were you gonna say?
Well, no, it's so funny that the interest for both of them, kind of like the crime as well as the horror, like there's always that psychological component and like the documentary factor that you just mentioned. Like, you want to know kind of the story behind the story. And I think that's really interesting.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Even like I was saying about the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Like the end part, the explanation.
Yeah, there's a scary story in there that eventually was turned into a movie. It was a Hitchcock movie, and I can't remember the name of it right now. Not a Hitchcock movie, but it was on Hitchcock's Presents, but I can't remember right now, was the story that's in Scary Tales Dark about the woman in Paris whose mother gets sick.
Okay.
And the mother, it's a story, it's an urban legend or whatever, but the mother gets sick and the daughter goes to get medicine. She comes back. I'm telling you the very much, like, a short version of the story. And the daughter comes back and the hotel that they were staying at, they're like, we have no record of you and your mother at all.
Right.
And they go to the room. The room's all changed, all this stuff, and she can't figure it out. Well, you know, it turned out that they had the mother had like the Black Plague or something, and they buried it. She died immediately after the daughter left, and they burned the body and hid it and changed the room around and wiped the existence of this woman being at their hotel, because not only did they not want the bad press, the hotel, they didn't want people in town, like in the city, to freak out.
Right.
And so I went, and in the back of that scary story book, he talks about how that's a true story. Huh. It really happened. And it was interesting about like the research he did to find out more about it. It was such an interesting sort of thing. There was, you know, Black Plague, but this woman was sick and they just didn't want, they were trying to hide it, you know, and it was such an interesting sort of thing. But yeah, I've always been kind of obsessed with that sort of aspect of horror, is sort of like, you know, what is the true story behind it?
Well, isn't that sound like, for me, I'm not a big horror person, but the horror that really scares me too is the stuff that is based, has a basis in reality.
Yeah. Have we talked about, I don't know if I told you guys, my girlfriend works, she works in corrections.
Oh.
Right. And so, yeah, so I was telling the story at Image Expo, so I wasn't sure if I told this to you guys. But with Nailbiter particularly, like, her and I talk about serial killers all the time, because she has to interview people who are killers and the scum of the earth. I don't know, like, straight up, like, child molesters and rapists, abusers, like, you know, the worst people in the world she has to deal with every day. There are times where her and I'll be talking and I'll be like, you know, how was the day? And she's like, oh, it was horrible. And I'll be like, so somebody really bad came in and like, oh, yeah, I had to interview somebody really bad. And I'm like, what'd they do? And in my brain, I'm like, I tell her, I'm like, listen, I'm a worst case scenario person. Like, whatever you're going to tell me is not going to be as bad as what's going on in my head. And then she'll tell me, and of course it's way worse.
Yeah.
You know, it's like way worse than I was thinking. And her and I, we talk a lot about this stuff and just sort of, I'm losing track of what I was going to say, but yeah, we just talk about this stuff a lot and sort of like how, the real, oh, you were saying about the real horror. Yeah. Like, so she talks about, it's like, it's disturbing. And you just realize like how much more reality is scarier than fiction, you know, like it's nuts. Like the things I hear about, I'm just like, God, that sounds horrible. How that doesn't sound real because it isn't over the top, exaggerated Freddy with claws, you know, it's like this primal, people are just fucked up. Like,
were talking today. Cause, you know, this week on the show, we're talking about fantasy and fantasy as a genre. And, and I was telling Aaron that like, I'm very, openly afraid of like pretty much everything. I'm still afraid of the dark. I have this love hate relationship with horror in general, because I've been always really fascinated by it, but I'm so aware of how it affects me psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
Yet anything that would be kind of horrific in a fantasy universe, I'm fine with, because I have multiple levels protecting me. There's nothing about it that's real.
Yeah.
When you start to actually talk about what's real in real life, like that's when it really bothers me. That's
It's crazy.
That, yeah, no, thank you.
Two things I want to say about that. One, because it's funny you're afraid of the dark. Like when you read Ghosted issue 8, there's a whole thing about the dark in there. Like, I don't want to give away for you, but the dark is a scary place. There's a whole thing where at one point, I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you what it is. Like,
thanks.
There's a part where Jackson is talking to this other person, this other bad guy character, and the guy is like, "We're gonna throw you in the dark." And Jackson is like, "The dark? Why would I? Why should I be afraid of the dark?" And the guy just turns, looks at him, and goes, "Exactly." And then the whole like issues 8, 9, and 10 is this whole idea of what is in the dark, and you don't. I don't want to tell you, but we'll get there. Like you'll see.
Oh, thanks, dude.
This whole thing with the dark. Oh, but so there's this woman who works at CBR named Casey.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. Did she tell you that like she knew the serial killer I was talking about?
No.
When I was up on stage, yeah, the serial killer I was talking about, in San Diego. She knew. So when I was on stage talking about it, she was like, "Oh, that's kind of interesting. That sounds like, you know," she knew a serial killer. And so her and I were talking during one of the interviews, and we realized that the serial killer I was talking about was the same serial killer she was talking about.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, isn't that crazy and spooky and creepy and stupid San Diego? California, man, it's all West Coast. It seems like the West Coast, California and Oregon and Washington, it's just like, so many serial killers over here. So many. That's how I came up with the idea for Nailbiter, because I grew up in Riverside. Oh, and yeah, horrible place. And so I grew up in Riverside, and I was watching the Zodiac, and there was a scene in the Zodiac where they were talking about how they thought the Zodiac was in Riverside, or had lived in Riverside for a certain time period and killed people there. And I remember when I was a kid, there were two other serial killers also in Riverside around the same time. And I was like, that's fucked up. With three different serial killers were all like living here, you know, like I haven't been to Riverside in years, but
that, especially, you know, 20 years ago, say, like Riverside was sort of, I mean, it still kind of is, but that was the no man's land outside of LA, you know, it was
where
people who couldn't afford to, or wanted to get away, or addicted to meth. I mean, it's like Riverside does not have a good,
delightful.
It's not delightful.
When I was younger, I had no idea of the meth problem. Like I don't know how we were able to avoid it or whatever, but I had no clue of it. And then I didn't know until I got to college. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh yeah, the meth capital of California. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
It makes sense because of all the desert, all the open land. You just go out there, you park your RV and start cooking.
It's now it's Eastern Oregon is the new Riverside, because, you know, it's just the wasteland, the high desert wasteland out in Eastern Oregon. They can't, it's easy to cook up your meth and, you know, start.
So crazy. God, such an empire. So funny. But, go ahead.
I guess I have a sort of heavy question for you. You don't have to answer it if you're not comfortable with it. But I'm also not going to couch it as less heavy than it is. I'm curious if you grew up with any kind of organized religion or faith, and like what your thoughts are on what happens when we die.
Oh man, that's a heavy question. I'll answer. It might take me a minute to get there. I'll have to kind of talk about this. I was totally raised Presbyterian.
Okay.
And it's a weird mix. Like, my dad's Presbyterian, my mom is Baptist. So it's like, it's all Christian, right?
Okay.
So when I was a kid, we would go to church. And I got some weird sort of stuff from it. I think it's pretty clear if people talk to me, like, Preacher's my favorite comic of all time. Because I think that the message that Garth Ennis is trying to talk about and him trying to, because Preacher is Garth Ennis trying to figure out religion as well. You know, it's him trying to get his head around it. And I've never done a story like that. I've actually thought about recently doing something similar. My thoughts on it are weird. I don't know. It's like when I was younger, we were growing up with it, and it was just interesting. Like, my family, they would go to church because it was the thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Not because they actually had faith.
Okay.
You know, not because it was like, you know, that's just the thing you were doing. And especially, I think, with baby boomers. I think baby boomers, that's still the thing to do. Like, they were like, you go to church on Sunday. Mm-hmm. My dad's family is really religious. Like, surprising. Okay. Surprisingly so. I think my last real experience with that kind of world was going to... I don't want to offend anybody with some of my opinions on organized religion, but I went to like church camp twice. I think once after fourth grade and once after, maybe even younger, I might have been after second. And then once after fifth grade, I went to see my uncle, who was really religious, for 2 weeks. And he is like super religious. And so I just sat there with him and asked I was like challenging him. And I realized in that conversation how much I didn't believe, but I realized at that point when someone has that amount of faith that there is nothing you can do to crack it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know,
that's the whole point. That's the whole point of faith too, right?
So there was nothing I could do to crack it. And so then,
but that's, you realized that when you were, what is that? Like 10, 11 years old that you,
yeah. Cause it was ridiculous to me that the things he was talking about, some of it, like the lengths he was going to, mm-hmm. for his faith.
Got it.
And I was being like a jerk, but I was being a little jerk. I was kind of a bad kid. So I was a little jerk. And, and then after that, we got out of it. And then when I was a little bit younger, or a little bit older, I'm sorry. So we stopped going to church. Whatever reason, my family, busy stuff, you know. Stopped going to church. My parents, this is therapy, so I'll go right into it. My parents went through a very lengthy divorce. Like crazy lengthy. I think it started when I was like 13 and it ended when I was 18, like right before I turned 19. Like, it was like a long, like, separation divorce proceedings of on and off for years. So church kind of got put on the wayside. But then when I was in high school, I got arrested. And so when I was in high school, which is, that's where people ask me about the crime stuff. I'm always like, my crime knowledge does not really come from books or movies.
that's fine. Real world experience is a good way to write too.
Yeah. There was an editor one time who was asking me all that. We were talking about crime. And I want to do crime comics even before Ghosted was coming out or anything, and he was like asking me his crime books, and he was like, well, how do you supposed to write about crime? You've never read any of these books. And I was like, so I got arrested when I was 14.
Okay.
And I went to juvenile hall. This whole thing. It's a whole long time.
It was serious.
Yeah, yeah. And at that moment my mom was like, we're going to church.
Oh, wow.
And so I was like, that went on for, I think, 1 week. Like, I went to one church once with her, and then I went to church once. And then I went to, like, the youth group thing.
Right.
And that just was not working. Yeah, it was. But also, it's really weird when you're like, because at that point, I think I was 15. So I was 15 and I went to church, and I remember being in the room, and I was just looking around the room, and I have this theory that if you're in a room with a bunch of douchebags, there's a good chance you're a douchebag. Mm. So I was looking around the room, my youth group, and I was just like, what a bunch of losers. Like, this is not cool at all. And I was like, you guys are just like,
can I ask you something? Yeah, go back though. Like, did you have the same feeling when you were in juvenile hall and you're sitting there with a bunch of kids there?
Oh, that was a bad kid. I know I fucked up. There was no argument there. But so yeah, I remember when I got out of juvenile hall though. I mean, that was really like an eye-opening kind of experience, you know, like the grass was definitely greener.
Yeah.
Life was definitely changed. I'm very thankful for those experiences because like every bad thing that's ever happened to me, I've always come out of them much, much better. And so the juvenile hall stuff, like there are certain members of my family that are, I'll just say it. My brothers are douchebags. So my younger brothers are both douchebags. And whenever I talk to people or my family or whoever, and they're like, why can't your brothers be more like you or whatever, which I think is a ridiculous subject anyway. But I get to that point where I'm like, man, both my brothers, like my brother loves my mom, my other brother loves my dad, and they're both like in their like late 20s now. Mm. Or not that far. They're 26 and 25 now, I think.
Yeah, 20s, okay.
But my thing is that they're like, they're doing nothing. And so I realized that the thing that really separates us is that experience, like juvenile hall stuff.
Like you fucked up and then you had a chance to sort of redeem yourself, essentially?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's very eye-opening. It's very eye-opening. You know, you grow up quickly. You know, you kind of realize what mistakes you made. But so then with the religious stuff, that was also the thing. And then while that was going on, I swear for a long time that I ended up dating nothing. For a long time, it always seemed like I would date nothing but women who were, like, religious.
Hmm.
And that was always an interesting thing, so I'd always be around them. And you constantly see it in different religions, and you start seeing different perspectives. And there were times I was like, it just isn't for me, you know? Like, I don't
mm-hmm. –
you can have faith, and I have sort of a – like, I guess if I was listed as anything, it would be agnostic because I think it's arrogant of me to think there's nothing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But at the same time, like, I don't go to church. I've read the Bible a few different times. I have sort of my own, like, theories on things, and I do think there's some kind of afterlife, but I have no idea what it is. I was just talking to my girlfriend about this the other day. We were talking about because she's super – agnostic. I mean, leaning more towards atheists, almost mockingly so.
Like, did she get to a point in her life where
she no, she was totally really no, like she's never been raised in any religion.
Uh-huh.
Like, she was pretty much raised atheist all the way through.
Okay,
so she's like, there's a little bit agnostic in there, like a little bit, but she's pretty much atheist. So it's interesting talking with her about that. I get sometimes where I'm like, my theories on the organized religious thing is that it's no different than we were talking about the tortoise and the hare. You know, it's like there are stories in there that you could probably learn things from and get things from. But for the most part, I feel like it's been so warped that people they use it for their own means so much. And that was one of the things I was really frustrated with when I was in high school. Because I would, you know, knew these women or when I was in high school, these girls. There were girls that I knew that I would date who were religious, and they would be all in the whole, like, the groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the church groups. And I would start realizing, like, it felt so fake to me.
Mm-hmm.
There's this website. So on Reddit, there is a thread on Disneyland and the horror stories that happen at Disneyland. And there's a whole thread on grad night. And then I think it's called, like, the Week of Lights.
Okay.
Where it's like they close the park at night for basically like religious groups to come in, and basically they have the park themselves. And they said the thing that they have, those are the nights, specifically the Week of Lights or whatever. It's like this Christian groups are able to take over Disneyland at nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
That's the nights they have to look for people fucking in the bushes. Like teenagers, like Christian teenagers are constantly fucking in the bushes, and they're like, so they have security and they have flashlights, and the whole thing is that, like, there's a rule. If you see that bush shake on its own, someone is fucking in it. And this is a problem, and I think that's so funny that, like, the amount of energy there is so crazy. Like, you are basically, I don't know.
Well, because a lot of organized religion, and, you know, this is different than... I try to separate, too, in these discussions of organized religion versus a belief in higher power, because organized religion is both its community and it's trying to tame the impulses of humanity, you know, and trying to, like, take reign of, like, what it, you know, just our primal instincts and everything else. And when you, you know, it's that debate of can you subjugate our instincts for, you know, this higher power, so on, and so. And what happens, and I think especially with kids, it just the bottle explodes, you know?
Instead of having a conversation, they're having rules.
Yeah.
And that's what you're going to get. I mean, I don't know, as I said, I was not the best kid in the world. So for me, religion was, like, never an option. It's such a weird thing. I don't know. It's funny when
I think especially when you're writing so much about, I don't know. I try to reconcile some of the themes in, like, more kind of horror, especially, like, the type of horror that you write. Like the
with Ghosted.
Ghosts, there's something inherently potentially faith-based in any supernatural horror because it is tied to death and what happens after we die. And so it was, I was just curious if you had considered any of your own beliefs in that regard, and or is it just fun to explore? I mean, because obviously you're marrying it with a heist story in and of itself. So we're already like way off in a different direction, which is great.
I turned into a fantasy thing, but there is sort of my own, I don't know, it's really weird. Like how do I explain this in a way that makes sense? Like, it's a weird thing, I guess, growing up with the culture we've grown up with, that like some people, okay, so some people, they look at hell as what they read in the Bible, or they look at this, but you know, it's hard to explain. There are times where if I believe in an afterlife, I would probably believe in something closer to what dreams may come, you know? But even then, with that understanding, it means that I do believe there is a purgatory of some kind. There is some sort of like even lower levels of hell. But then I feel like it's almost unfair, and I get like, well, that's not really true. You know, like, I don't believe people who commit suicide are banished to some absolute
You can talk yourself out of it.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think with ghosts, the ghost stuff with the religious aspect and sort of the fantasy element with Ghosted, part of it I can't get into because there is a larger thing at play that's going on in the book that hasn't fully developed yet. Like, it's not all the pieces are being laid out for people. Like, when you get to issue 8 and then issue 11, 8 and 11, there's a clue in 8. There's a clue in 6, but there's a clue in 1. There's a clue in 6. There's a clue in 8. You get a little bit closer to 11. 11, there's a huge one. Like, 11, it's like, I pretty much lay some stuff out, and you start getting a better idea of kind of what's going on with Jackson and sort of that world.
Got it.
But it's going to keep building. And so some of my own personal beliefs about death are going to be really, because that book is about, it's so funny, we talk about ghosts, but it's really about death. I mean, that's Jackson's whole thing at the very beginning, is that he's like, he's fully accepted that he's ready to die.
Right.
And I think that's a very powerful moment for someone to do, to be like completely at peace with their own death. Is extremely powerful. And so that is really what a lot of Ghosted is really about, is Jackson and him kind of overcoming that and sort of finding the will to live again. Because he's not, the thing is that Jackson thinks that he has accepted death, but he has not accepted that he has given up on life. And those are two different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so slowly what's going on in the book is that Jackson is going to not only not give up on life, but he's going to come to terms with death at some point. Like, he's going to sort of have that moment because he's so surrounded by it, and it is in his wake. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you guys haven't have you read 6 yet?
Yeah
So, you know, the lady at the beginning is sort of like, the witch at the beginning is talking about him and sort of how he keeps escaping death.
Right.
As it goes on, there's like bad things are going to continue happening to him. Mm-hmm. There's a scene 10 that I almost cried writing. But it's, things are going to happen like that. Like, you just sort of have those, it's just to keep going like that. And it's, you know, if I get to tell the story I want, in the end, you know, I'm hoping that I can show how Jackson got to a point where, at the beginning when he says, like, he's just happy he's going to die soon, like, that was a lie.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, by the time we get to the ending, he'll be much more accepting of it. And a lot of my thoughts on the afterlife are going to be in that. And so I don't want to get too much into it, because, like, that's really cool. What, you know, because I think that Jackson's, he's an interesting character for me, and I hope he comes across as a guy who's just given up. And that's why he is such a dick all the time, because he's so bitter and angry. I was talking to somebody about this, and they were talking about how in Ghosted 5 there's that shot of him when you realize, like, what had happened to his team. And you can tell he looks younger. And the next panel is him talking to Marcus, and he looks so much older and colder and broken. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, it's intentional. Like, he really is he's broken. Like, he's really screwed up and just kind of along for the ride in a way. And no matter what he does, every time he thinks he even has a moment of peace, he gets dragged back into it. And is it because – and the thing is that, like, in 6 – there's a moment you think, like, oh, well, he was escaped, he was free, and they pulled him back. And it's like, yeah, but the reason why I pulled him back was because he fucked up before. Like, there was a, he's paying for something he did before.
Well, it's you know, it's a play on words in a way, too, because he's haunted by his past. And that past keeps coming back to you know, resurrect itself.
Right.
Yeah.
How much more do you have it planned out past that?
It's a 30.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to get to 30. You never know. I mean, sales could always bottom out, and I would have to finish at 20 or something. But that's the whole thing, is I want to make sure that I'm able to do what I want to do with Jackson, because it is his story, and sort of get him to that, even that place where I have that moment with him, and I'm curious if people are going to, what they're going to think, you know, about that, the final moments for him in the book, sort of what, where he goes. I don't know. I feel like his fate is already, like, people, I don't know who I was talking to about it, but they were like, well, I know how Jackson's story is going to end. I'm like, yeah, but you know how he's going to get there. You know,
the
like,
journey is so much more interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And then I think, I don't know, we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what people think of it once we get there.
Well, I have a more, a lighter note question for you then.
Yeah, go ahead.
Always bring the lighter questions, Myers.
Yeah, I'm not the heavy guy. So what are you reading or watching for fun these days when you need to get away from comics for a bit? And it could be, you could be reading comics. It's just what, you know, what's the, because you said even at the beginning, like, you're into comics. Like,
yeah, I bought a bunch of stuff today. I was reading Invaders when I was waiting for you guys just now. I bought a bunch of stuff. They're on the other side of the room, though. They're on the side of my office. But I bought, like, a stack of comics today. Like, I bought a good stack. And then I, I buy a lot of comics. My budget, it used to be 100. Now it's, like, 200.
Oh, wow.
A month on comics.
Oh, okay.
But I buy trades. No, a week? Jesus, I'm not crazy. But Thank I do you. Buy a lot of hardcovers.
Hey, come
I
on.
I do buy a lot of hardcovers.
All
right. Like, I buy a lot of hardcovers. I have a huge, like, collection of hardcovers. When I was thinking about this recently, before I moved to Portland, I had, like, 80 long boxes of comics, and then I had, like, 20 long boxes just of trades.
Mm-hmm.
And most of that's, oh, no, so all the comics are gone. I sold them all when I moved. And now, once a year, I go through what I have, and I keep, like, some things that I think are great. But anything that's been recollected in a trade is gone. Like, I get rid of it.
Mm.
And I will buy things twice. So, like, Hawkeye, something I bought twice. Buy the issues, buy the hardcover.
Right.
Same with Daredevil. Chew, Fear Agent. I'm, like, looking around the room right now.
Mm-hmm.
The TV show that I've been watching lately has been Justified. Like, I've been just burning through that because I'm really far behind. But
it's so good.
I know. Well, the thing is I got kind of this mode of, like, just binging on certain shows. Like, I watched Breaking Bad as it was coming on. When Breaking Bad ended, I started watching The Shield. I never watched The Shield before, so I watched all The Shield.
Mm-hmm.
And then when The Shield was over, I started watching Justified. So, or when I finished watching The Shield months ago, I started watching Justified.
That's good. Those are good crime shows.
I know. Yeah, they're good. It's funny. I had never seen Shield before, and I felt like I had missed out. But I'm glad I get to binge on it, you know? Like, yeah. Especially that last season, I was like, man, there's no way I could have watched this weekly. I would have gone crazy.
Yeah.
What else do I watch? I watch a lot of HBO stuff. I was just talking to a friend last night about Californication. Yeah, like Hank Moody, dude. Hank Moody is also Jackson. Like, Jackson is pulled from so many different places, but, like, a lot of David Duchovny is in there. a lot of Hank Moody. A lot of David Duchovny is in there.
David Duchovny does fuck it really well. He just has that same, I don't know, not everybody can pull off that, like, whatevs kind of attitude, but with an edge to it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He's the actor that if I, in a perfect world, I would want him to play Jackson.
Yeah.
Now I'm leaning toward Walter Goggins a little bit. I mean, because I don't think, Jackson has an accent, but it never comes off in the writing. Like, he has a little bit of, like, a southern accent, but it never comes off. I was talking to someone about this. Like, a lot of my characters have accents, but I don't do anything to, like, make it obvious. It's just for me. It's just for me. You know, it's for me, because then I get to sit here in my house and I can do the accent and it helps me get in character.
So is that, like, a conversation with the characters too? Like, that's how you can separate it between your own internal monologue and, like, the characters kind of monologue to you?
Yeah, yeah. Like, though, I can hear their voices and I can, in the way they talk.
So why do you not put it in the actual writing?
I don't know. I think it's a little bit there at times. It just depends. I think there's this other book I might do. I'm not 100% sure I'm going to do it yet. Like, another publisher asked me, and I wasn't sure if I was going to do it or not. But then I started realizing a character I wanted to create to be the point of view character for it. And that character was going to be from the South. And when I was writing them, just sort of like getting the mode of it, and I was writing that character, like, if I actually did that book, you would 100% know where they were from.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way around it by the way they talk. I don't know. I think it's because I don't know the dialect that well.
Got it.
And I don't want it to be completely fake. I don't want to be like, this character's from the South, and then they say things that are not very Southern.
Yeah.
But it's just sort of in my head, you know, like it's just kind of the way things are. And then so Jackson has a little bit. It's funny. Jackson is a little bit of like a Southern rapper. Best way to put it. Because like I'll listen to Macklemore, which is not a Southern rapper, but I'll listen to Macklemore, who's actually from Washington, I believe. But I'll listen to Macklemore, and I believe that Jackson was, I believe Jackson would totally listen to Macklemore. And so I'll listen to Macklemore, and there's a certain rhythm to the way Jackson talks
comes
from that.
Hmm.
Jackson's funny because Jackson, what I'll do a lot of times, the way I start writing Ghosted is I'll go for a walk or something, and I'll start just having the conversation, you know, whatever it is that Jackson's doing and saying, and sort of go from there. Because everyone's always reacting to Jackson because he is the center. And so just start figuring out what he's going to say and how everyone else will react to it. And that's how I write Ghosted. I start with him, whatever he's saying, and kind of go around him. He's such a shithead though. So it can be, that's the only thing. You gotta keep the Jackson-isms going at times.
Well, we unfortunately have to wrap up. I mean, I feel like I have 1,000 more questions for
you. Well, let's do one more. If you have one more, you can shoot at me.
We tend to end with like a super open-ended, frustrating one, like any last words for the good of the order, which often stymies, like whoever we're talking to, like, last words, how do you encapsulate any last bits of wisdom? But I'm just going to throw that one at you. Like, what else do you want to put out there quickly that we didn't cover? I don't know, Captain Midnight or any last bits about Nailbiter, whatever you want.
I guess read my comics.
That's a good one.
You know,
yeah, that comes up frequently.
read Ghosted. But I think because I know a lot of people who listen to that, oh man, I was just talking to someone about this yesterday. How do I put this out? It's coming off horrible. Well, I think a lot of your readers probably want to work in comics.
Uh-huh.
Right?
So, and I don't know. I'd be interested to find that out for real. Just
yeah, it'd be interesting. I think
we had some pretty good feedback because we talked to Frank Barberi too, and we had a lot of people kind of comment on that. Like he talked about like, you know, making comics and industry stuff, and people responded to that well.
Yeah, they should. So what I'll say is this, I'm going to leave it sort of out there, but I think that having perspective in life is very important. And I think that when you're trying to break into comics, being able to step back and know where you're at in your career and know who you are in your story is very important. Mm-hmm. And knowing where you are in your own story and having that perspective. You know, there's a scene in Grant Morrison's Invisibles where it's in bloody hell in America and they're going to, they're at a diner. And Fanny goes in the bathroom and this like big biker guy comes in and he notices that Fanny is a man, right? Or is a transvestite.
Mm-hmm.
And they come out and biker guy is pissed and like yelling and they're arguing. And King Mob stops the guy and he's just like, who are you right now? Like, if this is a movie, like, am I Arnold Schwarzenegger or am I a vampire? You don't know. Like, he tries to explain it to him, right? Like, and it's sort of like how in Castle, the reason why Castle is able to solve crimes is he's able to stop and look at what's going around him as if it was a story, and that gives him perspective on what's going on. I think that's important people to have if you're trying to break into comics or work in comics, period, is be able to, or in life, but really we're talking about comics, is to have that moment of where are you in your story, who are you in your story, and having some form of perspective to be able to look around and be like, okay, well, this makes sense, and to know that not everyone's story is the same. There you go.
I think that was perfect.
Being introspective is a good thing.
Yes, of course. Well, I often find people who are really upset about where they're at in comics, but they don't realize they're just starting out, and everyone has to start somewhere, you know? And,
yeah.
Sure.
You know, not everyone can just fly to the top of the mountain. You got to climb it.
Yeah.
I think that's a perfect note to end on.
Aw.
So, well, thanks, Josh, for joining us on the couch this week. Thanks to everyone listening, and thanks for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on the site as always, comicstherapy.com. We'll see you next week.
Hi. Difficult to remember, especially as so many children's books are fantasy, but what I'll always remember is The Brothers Lionheart by Astrid Lindgren. Our teacher in elementary school read it to us. Not much later, I read the book myself. I like to ascribe my love for fantasy to this book. Best regards, Tobias.
I've just closed my eyes again. Climbed aboard the Dreamweaver train. Trying to take away my